Hello and welcome to Double Take, a podcast by investors for investors, brought to you by Newton Investment Management. I'm Rafe Lewis, head of Newton's specialist investment research teams.
And I'm Newton investigative research analyst Jack Encarnacio. And on today's episode, we dive into the state of diversity and disclosure at public companies. You know, we read a lot of these days about corporations flexing their values, putting culture and ethics above seems virtually all else, but now we must ask, is all that messaging going from abstract marketing to reality? And how precisely can investors account for these changes and, dare I say, quantify them?
We have some terrific guests to help us plumb the depths of diversity disclosure today. Up first is Amanda Sonneborn, a law partner at King & Spalding, which is an international law firm where she works in the firm's global human capital and compliance practice, helping blue chip corporate clients navigate these as yet uncharted waters. Following Amanda will be her colleague, Darren Gardner, who runs the firm's human capital practice management and will speak to the global lay of the land. And then after Darren, we'll bring on Robert Ludke. He's a senior fellow at the Harkin Institute, who will take us on a deep dive into inclusion of disabled persons everywhere from boardrooms to Main Street and beyond.
So let's tee up Amanda just a little bit more. Amanda advises and represents clients across multiple industries in strategic employment-related issues in the U.S., including employment, employee benefits, labor relations, diversity issues. Amanda has handled a wide variety of litigation matters, labor organizing campaigns and collective bargaining, senior executive investigations, projects relating to workforce reorganizations and diversity strategy. She has advised employers on complex issues relating to harassment and discrimination claims, pay equity strategy, and worker misclassification. So it's really a pleasure to have you, Amanda. Welcome to Double Take.
Hi, thank you for having me here. I'm glad to speak with you today.
Oh, we have a lot to learn. I can't wait to hear what you're thinking. So Amanda, you know, we'd love to start this episode out with some level setting of sorts. So the Securities and Exchange Commission here in the US in November 2020, they issued a rule mandating public companies to disclose material human capital considerations. And from what we hear, there's a follow-on rule that could be proposed anytime now that would add additional teeth to that rule. But let's focus on that 2020 rule first. Can you explain what it has meant for corporate America? You know, whether we're seeing widespread compliance or is there pushback? You know, in other words, how challenging is it to comply with this rule and are corporates meeting the moment?
So the short answer to your question is what it means varies from client to client, because the SEC provided very little guidance in mandating the new human capital reporting. It simply said that companies were to report material information regarding their human capital in their 10K filings. On the short sort of abbreviated question of whether or not companies are complying, the answer is yes. You know, companies are not ignoring the requirement. They noticed that it was new and there, and have attempted to comply with it. But really the lack of clarity by the SEC about what they were looking for has left it up to individual corporations to define for themselves what they consider to be material information regarding human capital. And I think that's reflected in the 10K, first round of 10K filings that we've already seen in terms of the variation in what companies have included. Some of the various topics that companies have addressed in those filings have included things like you were previously mentioning, diversity, equity, and inclusion statistics, you know, information around various participation in the company's employee population of various different groups. There's also been statistics around retention and recruitment and things of that nature. Some companies, particularly in the 2021 disclosures, did address things such as layoffs or large-scale reductions in force. So there has been some more numerical types of information that have been shared, but the vast majority of companies have largely stuck to a more narrative form, where in the disclosures, they are broadly describing sort of their people and their approach to people management, their approach to issues like diversity, equity, and inclusion, and their support for people throughout their workforce. Very much more similar to what you might see in investor relations materials that describe employee issues.
And Amanda, what are you advising clients when it comes to materiality? I mean, that sounds like that old line from the U.S. Supreme Court justice, whose name is eluding me at the moment, who said something to the effect of, I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. Like, what is material in the realm of human capital management disclosure?
So I think that's a bit challenging for employers to identify simply because of some competing concerns. One and probably foremost being issues related to confidentiality. So if an employer is anticipating, for example, conducting a large scale reduction in force or taking some negative employment action, they have struggled with when do they required to disclose that vis-a-vis their workforce population, because the filings may be due prior to the point in time, for example, when it's announced to employees. We have seen the SEC has come out more recently with regard to enforcement actions and certainly suggested and made quite clear, frankly, that large-scale investigations, either by government agencies or litigation regarding discrimination and harassment, is definitely something that they will consider to be material. So that has provided some greater clarity than from what we had in the initial rounds. And companies, I think, who are facing those actions are certainly weighing the costs and benefits of disclosing that information and what level of detail to provide that regarding that information, particularly if there's ongoing litigation or administrative actions.
Yeah, I'm thinking Oh, go ahead, Amanda, please.
And I was going to say, I think another area that companies are wrestling with this question of materiality also relates to their workforce outside of the United States. Obviously, for many multinational companies, the obligations that they have in other countries vis-a-vis their workforces require things such as consultation with unions, interaction with government agencies as changes are contemplated, when and how and if they have to make those disclosures in the U.S., and how that marries up with the various regulatory or labor obligations in other countries is certainly something else we see companies wrestling with.
How would you sort of explain why these kinds of disclosures are important? Why keeping track of the diversity of your workforce is important? What interest is being served when, you know, rules come down from the SEC and folks are sort of mobilized to think about this and disclose this?
So I have a two-part answer to that question. I think one thing is relevant to understand is how the human capital disclosures came to be from the SEC, because it's somewhat unique and quite frankly, not largely talked about in the press. And that is that large pension and benefit funds put pressure on the SEC to require these disclosures. So large union pension and benefit funds were the primary drivers of the disclosures during a Republican administration, and they were able to be pushed through. I think that's a unique perspective that indicates sort of the backing and why, who it was at least initially that thought that the disclosures were important and were pushing them forward. The second part of my answer to your question is, I think it goes directly to the fact that human capital and people more generally are looked at as a very important part of corporate business and strategy today. When I started practicing employment law 20 years ago, employees and issues related to employment were largely looked at as simply sort of a cost center, a risk analysis. Today, many companies see their people as a value add and as a strategic resource that they need to recruit, retain, support. And these metrics are a way, I think, of providing public disclosure around how those companies are doing on those various issues. While we're still all struggling with exactly how to define it and exactly what would reflect success on the people measures, which is why I think you haven't seen the clarity around what exactly is required, I think the disclosures reflect a common understanding, or at least an increasingly common understanding, that how a company does as an employer is an important part of the analysis of how successful the company will be, just like all of the other metrics and data that the SEC has long required be disclosed.
Yeah, and speaking as investors, certainly the more disclosure of every metric, the better for us. It just makes it easier to analyze and model a company, right? But is there any evidence that the very requirement of disclosure now almost 2 years later is leading to a more inclusive and diverse private sector? Like our CEO saying, geez, we don't want to, you know, look as bad as I think we look right now on paper. We better, you know, take some serious activity in the human resources department and try to you know, get all kinds of different diversity and inclusion going within our company? Or, you know, conversely, is this an opportunity for greenwashing?
Every client I work for is focused on diversity. And I work with a significant number of very large public and private companies in the US and globally. And every single one of them is focused on addressing diversity challenges. That does not mean, and I think part of the challenge with the data is that the challenges have been remedied or fixed overnight. Addressing systems to help support more diverse employees be successful in a lawful way is something that will take time and is not something that can be achieved quickly. So I think I actually have the different approach or different belief than sort of the greenwashing mentality with regard to diversity, equity, and inclusion. I see companies attempting to or dedicating significant time and resources to address the issue, but I certainly don't believe it is something that can be remedied quickly. And the companies that I have seen where they try to, set sort of unofficial quotas or put things in place to make change very rapidly, that often backfires and creates other challenges. So in my experience and the clients I work with, people are very dedicated to the issue. They are spending significant time and resources to it, and it's not simply lip service, but it is not something that can be remedied within one financial year.
Amanda, what do you hear from your clients relative to, geez, you know, I would love to be able to tell you with certainty what different, ethnic and racial groups my employees fit into, but I don't know. I can't be sure. You know, you can't just assume by a last name, for instance. And maybe employees don't necessarily want to tell me, or maybe they don't, you know, check a particular ethnic or racial box. How about that challenge?
That certainly is a challenge, and I think it will become more challenging. It actually relates back to a point that goes to the question you asked earlier about global standards. So in most other countries, privacy laws in large part prohibit employers from asking at least the breadth of questions that employers can ask in the US about various category participation status for protected categories. California is instituting a new privacy law for employees in 2023. The regs have not been released yet, so it's not entirely clear what the parameters of that will be, but they've indicated that they want to follow the law that's currently in place in large part in the EU, which largely restricts asking employees those kinds of questions. So I think those concepts in the US are going to be even more challenging. Today, it's not a mandatory participation. Employees can voluntarily provide that information. So obviously if employees are not providing it, the data that's reflected is not going to be accurate. I think to the extent we see other legal barriers such as privacy laws put in place, limitations on employers' ability to ask those questions, measuring diversity, equity, and inclusion in the United States will only become more of a challenge.
Amanda, there is widespread expectation that the SEC is going to come out with a different and kind of beefed up version of this human capital management disclosure rule. I'd love to get a preview from you to the extent you have thoughts about it. What do you think is going to be in there? How challenging is it going to be for public companies to deal with this? And will it, you know, put investors like us in a position where we have a lot more visibility into these matters?
So yes, we anticipate there will be greater clarity, although quite frankly, we thought we probably would have seen it sooner than we have thus far. I think we can anticipate, based on some of the enforcement actions and some of the more public statements, that things like pay equity data and information around pay equity very well may be part of what's required in the disclosures. That would be following a trend that we've seen from states starting in California, but as well New York, Colorado, Illinois, where the larger states are requiring employers to provide much more significant public information going forward around pay equity. I think we also will anticipate that information around litigation, administrative actions will be required to be disclosed and will be identified as material. And that's where we've seen the SEC particularly active in this space. I think an interesting place to watch is whether or not they also mandate information around changes in compensation and benefits. In the US, employers have large discretion to make changes to comp and benefits. Only less than 6% of the U.S. private sector employees are represented by a union. So that means for the most part, most employees can have their terms and conditions of employment changed very quickly. I think it will be interesting to see if the disclosures require general statements about changes to things like retirement benefits or other compensation.
Will be interesting, and we'll be watching closely, and we'll have a nice guide to watch it with, thanks to Amanda Sonneborn, our first guest this week on Double Take, talking about the state of inclusion and disclosure from human capital management perspective at public companies. It's a pleasure to have you, Amanda. Thank you so much for getting us started. Great to hear from you.
Thank you for your time today.
Okay, now let's pivot to Darren Gardner. So Darren leads King & Spalding's global human capital and compliance practice, which is no mean feat. In the course of his career, Darren has undertaken more than 500 multi-jurisdictional strategic, transactional, and compliance-related projects covering more than 170 different countries. He's a trusted advisor to many of the world's largest companies and corporations in matters ranging from day-to-day, complex, cross-border employment issues on a single country basis to large, complex, multi-jurisdictional workforce projects. Darren Gardner, welcome to Double Take.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it is really great to have you, Darren. I will echo that. And as we've been talking about, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission implementing more and more regulations around disclosure, standards companies have to meet around their human capital management procedures and sort of the nature of their workforce. We hoped you could help us gain a little more global perspective on the question, sort of from a workplace culture and expectations perspective. You know, how does human capital management practice globally contrast with what we're accustomed to in the United States?
The way that the reporting typically works in other countries is that you report either through a labor authority or a specific authority that oversees that particular issue. It's less common, in my experience, to have a broader reporting requirement that applies to human capital issues as a function of an investor consideration. So I think what we are seeing is with a lot of things from an employment perspective, the US is often the slowest to adjust, and it's perhaps because of the US is built for commerce and it's a jurisdiction where the business considerations have driven growth.
On the diversity and inclusion piece, Darren, just particular to Europe, how important is it perceived to be in Europe that you be forthright and seek to improve the level of diversity and inclusion within your workforce? Is it considered an important issue, an increasingly important issue, or sort of old hat because of the different compliance structure you've been talking about?
I think it is already an important issue, and I think it is becoming an increasingly important issue. And the types of characteristics that are that are covered are going to expand, and I think with the globalization of US business and some of the categories, particularly on the self-identification front, that you see US companies measuring the traditional gender and disability, I think is recognized globally. And certainly in places you might not expect. There are countries in Asia that have mandatory quotas for employing disabled folks as part of your workforce once you hit a threshold number of employees. Most companies, particularly operating internationally, the local companies understand and appreciate it, but the multinational companies who go into jurisdictions don't necessarily understand it. And I think that's probably the point to tie it together here is if you're talking about local operations and how those are administered, I think they are different to large multinationals because the local operations, you are typically part of the fabric of the economy. You've got some history, you operate in the local language, and you're used to the nuances and idiosyncrasies of the laws that operate there. If you are running a global business, and I think this is the glue of the point that I'm making, you are dealing with all of those local issues, but you've got to try and navigate them and operate your business on a global basis without having 150 different systems. What that means is that as you centralize and coordinate and try to operate a commercial enterprise, you know, with that kind of breadth, the workforce issues and the compliance elements of it, and what you do from a development, attraction, retention point of view, and the materiality of it to your business, is going to become much clearer, and is also going to filter up and ultimately, I think, become reportable. So I think multinational businesses are in a position where they are dealing with a matrix of laws that don't all operate the same way, that are not all conceptually consistent. The advantage Europe has over many other places as a region is that because of the way that certain directives work and because of the requirements under them and how that is administered under local law, you have a degree of consistency. You don't have that elsewhere. So in terms of the importance of things like diversity and inclusion, it is paramount in some places because you've got a reporting obligation, you're going to get measured on it, and there are compliance consequences if you don't meet it. But if you're a multinational corporation, it has to be very important, and it has to be something that you strive for, because you have to meet those legal obligations. You also are not going to be able to develop and recruit and retain talent without it. So from a European perspective, going back to the question, it is a, you know, it's already very important. It is, it's going to become more important. And I think the elements of what is in the diversity topic and how it's measured and where is going to grow. So I think you'll see more around, and again, the consequences are different, but veteran status in the US is something that a lot of companies will want to have identified. You have mandatory military service in some other countries. So how you balance it is difficult, and what you do about reporting it is somewhat problematic. It doesn't change the importance of it, nor does it change the evolution of the concept, so that to be a well-recognized, highly compliant top brand around the world, you have to be able to tie it all together. And what it's ultimately going to do if you are a public company in the US is mean that how you do it will end up being reported.
That's really interesting. And you're bringing up kind of a central challenge in a more ESG-focused analysis that we've been running across, which is, you know, on the one hand, we in the West, you know, when we're analyzing a company in an emerging market, frequently have to kind of struggle with whether we apply our own cultural norms and expectations when evaluating a company's, you know, workforce and processes and culture. And yet, on the other hand, what you're saying is in a lot of these other jurisdictions, A, there's potentially a lot more transparency. B, there may be more explicit government mandates around this stuff. And then C, you may have a much more homogeneous, ethnically, racially, et cetera, populace, and therefore a workforce. So, you know, I'm wondering what you can say to investors out there who are trying to struggle with this. How do we mesh this all together to do it in a way that's fair and kind of equitable when we're looking at these companies?
I think it's really understanding the business and the location. I'm a huge proponent of the greater the diversity, the more the better and more effective the economic performance, and the greater the value to the corporation, because that kind of having that kind of interaction and having the ability to have a heterogeneous workforce that delivers in a consistent way is, I think, what everybody is ultimately striving for. Look, I think there are going to be challenges, and I think there are going to be issues simply because people make assumptions. And it's the point of, if you're used to operating in a particular jurisdiction, everybody naturally assumes that their jurisdiction is the most complicated and, you know, is the most evolved and developed. What you often find is that may be the case on certain elements, but not others. And so how you put together what you do locally and you adjust it for what you want to do globally is exceptionally important. You know, the concept that you raised of race, I mean, how do you measure that in certain countries where the factors are different? Now, gender is, as I said, gender and disability, that is why they are the most common, because they are probably the easiest to be able to identify and to impact through the law. There are going to be others, and I think around, you know, the LGBTQ concept is going to evolve, but, you know, in some places it's homosexuality is a criminal offense. So how you balance what it is that you have to do in some places with what you want to do and then what you actually must do is the challenge for large multinational companies. And when you tie that back to reporting requirements, it creates a you know, from a technical point of view and from a legal perspective and from the compliance lens, it creates some serious challenges, because what you must do, what you want to do and what you should do don't necessarily align because of the way the legal concepts are explained and enforced.
Darren Gardner of King & Spalding's Global Human Capital and Compliance Practice, a real pleasure to hear from you. Thanks for helping us get a more global perspective on these human capital management questions.
Appreciate you talking to me.
Welcome back to the second half of our deep dive on the state of diversity and inclusivity of public companies. Let's dive deeper still, shall we? Joining us now is Robert Ludke, an author and a senior fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, which focuses on research and engagement to generate greater integration of people with disabilities on boards of directors, management teams, and, well, everywhere.
That's right. He's fresh off a speaking engagement at the Davos World Economic Forum's annual meeting, and he's joining us from the Harkin Summit in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Bob, welcome to Double Take.
Well, thank you very much, Rafe and Jack. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and it's really a wonderful opportunity to have this conversation in conjunction with the Harkin Summit here in Belfast.
Well, you know, human capital management has been on our minds a lot lately, but probably most investors, you know, with the rise of ESG and sustainability factors getting integrated into how all of us think about how we're going to invest. But you know, we're going to now dive into the disability topic, and let's cleave it in two. Okay, first, let's talk about the state of inclusivity of disabled persons on the boards of directors, corporate management level. And then secondly, we can get into kind of, you know, the economy more broadly. Does that sound good?
That sounds like a great plan. Yep.
Excellent. So, you know, we heard in our first interview about, I think it's fair to say, the checkered state of disclosure and inclusivity generally in the United States and worldwide right now. So can you give us the skinny specifically in regard to people with disabilities in the corporate world? Where are we today? Where did we come from and where are we going?
Well, on one hand, you know, I think we need to look at disability for what it is, which is the ultimate intersectional characteristic that defines people, right? It cuts across race, gender, sexual orientation, religious beliefs, veteran status, you name it, it cuts across all of that. We also have to recognize that at some point in our lives, every single one of us will be born with disability, will have a disability. Some people are born with disabilities. Some people age into their disabilities. As you get older, certainly you lose some of your cognitive ability, you lose some functional mobility. And, you know, if you fall off your bike tomorrow and you break your arm, well, you're temporarily disabled. So disability cuts across every one of us. It's really part of our lives. So with all that being said, as a backdrop, the state of disclosure among, you know, should we just say the C-suite and boards of directors, I wouldn't even say checkered is an accurate characteristic. I would say it's non-existent. For example, last year, the Valuable 500, which is an organization based in the United Kingdom in London, that is represents the 500 CEOs of the world's biggest companies who've made a commitment to they themselves driving disability inclusion into their companies, published a study that found that not a single board member of the top 100 companies in the FTSE 100 disclosed themselves as being disabled. Given that the fact that 15% of the world's population is disabled, and I would argue almost double that, probably has another 15% of people are disabled, but don't disclose it for whatever reason. And any number of us have, you know, connections to people with disabilities, friends, family members, and so on. So that level of disclosure is again, a mathematical impossibility. And that has very, very serious consequences. The most serious being that if the leaders of an organization are not open and honest about their disability, they don't create an environment in their company that allows their workforce to be open and honest about their disability. And that allows, or that prevents, I should say, their employees from bringing their true selves to work. And I think, as we'll talk about later in the conversation, you know, that limits the innovative potential, that limits the creativity, the collaboration that bringing your true self to work allows.
You know, Bob, can I want to follow up on something you said there, because you were talking about the kind of mathematical impossibility, I guess, of these boards not having disabled persons, you know, among them. And yet, when I think back in the United States, for example, there were, you know, many, many corporate boards that did not have women, that did not have people of color, even though mathematically you should have thought they should have been there because they're obviously massive percentages of the population. So, you know, I guess the skeptic in me wonders, are disabled people somehow being excluded, or is this really about visibility, disclosure, and tracking?
I think it is a combination of all of the above. For a whole host of systemic societal reasons, many persons with disabilities have not been on the career path that would, shall we just say, interest companies as they are recruiting boards of directors. You know, too often persons with disabilities are consigned to entry-level positions or forced to work in the gig economy. And so, you know, those structural impediments don't allow them to move up the career ladder in a way that, again, appeals to recruiters and boards of directors. Obviously, you have any number of people serving on boards of directors who are, in fact, disabled, but for whatever reason, and, you know, I mean, you want to give people the benefit of the doubt, they don't feel comfortable or don't feel able to disclose the disability. And then, I think it is a sad reality in life that there's discrimination in all forms across society. And anyone that's kind of outside the typical mold of a board of director tends to be overlooked or excluded from, you know, being recruited to serve on a board of directors. So long story short, I just think there are a lot of barriers that have prohibited and limited the number of people with disabilities from serving on the boards.
Bob, you've been an advisor to policymakers and lawmakers in both houses of the U.S. Congress, globally as well. You understand what's happening inside the Beltway, let's say. When it comes to laws and regulations compelling disclosure of human capital data and statistics, are folks meeting the moment and the need? In other words, can we as investors get an adequate view of a company's diversity and inclusivity of disabled persons just by reading corporate sustainability reports, 10K filings, that sort of thing?
No, you can't. And that's another problem. And, you know, you as investment professionals, you know this far better than I do in terms of the importance of data and metrics and measurement when it comes to, you know, accountability and integrating that into business performance and so on. So it's estimated that only about just over 6% of all companies voluntarily disclose their workplace demographic data. Obviously, you know, companies of certain sizes are required to disclose limited amounts of their workforce demographic data to the U.S. government, of which disability criteria is not one of the indicators that's collected by the U.S. government, the Department of Labor specifically. So it is incredibly difficult, but not impossible, you know, to really get to the connection between disability inclusion and firm performance, like we have seen so much over the last decade or 15 years on the connection between ESG, investment returns, firm performance, and so on. However, having said that, there's a glimmer of hope on the horizon. It's expected that in the coming months, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, later in 2022, the Securities and Exchange Commission will issue a rule that will build on its existing rule around how companies are to disclose their investments and their human capital. I think it is reasonable to expect that disability inclusion considerations will be part of that rule. Now, whether or not they make it into the final policy, it's to be determined. But I do think that there's a growing awareness that, there more needs to be collected on kind of workforces broadly, but, kind of demographic criteria specific to disability status in particular.
Bob, I would imagine there are some kind of legal and privacy obstacles here a little bit. I'm thinking about HIPAA, the healthcare, privacy law in the United States, for example, or just the fact that many disabled people don't necessarily identify as, disabled as kind of a primary, kind of demographic category for themselves. And so how do you get around some of these obstacles, both legal and kind of highly personal, to have accurate, data disclosures here?
I touched on the personal a bit earlier in the conversation in terms of, it is really important for any organization, not just a company, but for any organization to, create this environment where people feel comfortable, again, where appropriate, to disclose their disability status. And obviously that's a bit of a chicken and egg thing, right? Where, what creates what? Is it the leadership that's creating more disclosure and that disclosure then creates more disclosure? Or is it a company knowing that they have a large disability population among their workforce and therefore the leaders are a bit more engaged? But, I think it goes without saying that the more culturally accepted an organization is to people bringing their true authentic selves to the job, the more open people are will be about what constitutes their authentic self. And obviously I don't want to to minimize the very important privacy protections and all that around the laws that have very good intent, but I think if the U.S. government already is collecting data on, gender breakdowns, race and ethnic breakdowns, I don't think just collecting, a broad identifier of disability status, such as percentage of employees in a company that identify as disabled, is necessarily impacting anyone's privacy. I mean, you're not probing deeply into what constitutes that disability. There's no judgment on what that disability may or may not be, but rather what is what's a general percentage of people identifying as disabled.
And Bob, this all comes back right to the idea that there is significant upside for a firm to be more attentive to the presence of disability in their company, to sort of put that consideration at the forefront. When we pivot this discussion to the economy more broadly, I wonder if you could give us your sense of what the business case is for inclusivity of the disabled at a corporate management, a product level. Is there evidence to suggest that, doing the right thing by the disabled also means doing the right thing by shareholders?
Yeah, there was, there was an Accenture study that I believe came out in 2018, and it looked at, the companies that did disclose their level of disability and disability engagement within their workforces. And they found that those companies actually outperformed their peers on any number of metrics, most notably return on investment. But I tend to look at this issue much more broadly. I look at it in terms of global market opportunity, right? So the total population of persons with disabilities, and again, I'm caveating this number because I think it is grossly underrepresented, but there are 1.85 billion people in the world that identify as disabled. That is about 300,000 people more than the entire population of China. If you add in to their friends and family members, that goes close to just over 3 billion people. The friends and family members and persons with disabilities have an annual disposable income of $13 trillion, right? The GDP of the European Union last year was roughly $15 trillion, right? So we're talking a market roughly the size of the European Union. Why wouldn't companies want to build products, innovate products, market products to access essentially the European Union, right? And what investor wouldn't want to be encouraging the companies that they invest in to go chase that market? And you also have to realize that that market actually spills over into the global economy. If you think about all the innovation that has come about for products that started as allowing the disabled population to live in a world that's not terribly accessible, but then found their way to mass use, that number and the values of that innovation is staggering. I mean, think about the cruise control features of your car, the Alexa, the dictation features of your iPhone, frankly, the internet. Those were all innovated, either for people or by people with disabilities. And we use them every day in our lives. So why aren't companies being more intentional in chasing that market, knowing that that market ultimately leads to a global market? And we use things that are created for persons with disabilities every day in our lives that we don't even think about. We don't even recognize. I mean, you know, keep in mind, you know, when you see a parent walking with their kids using a stroller and they use a curb cut, well, that was designed to help persons with disabilities better navigate their you know, lived environment, their neighborhoods. If you're walking with a suitcase, you're using that curb cut as well. So these are all things that we end up using. And these are all things that create lasting value for society. Those are the kinds of things that I believe companies need to be more intentional about, because it's good for their shareholders, it's good for the company, but frankly, more important, it's good for society.
And Bob, I'll just bloviate for a second here and say that I've been reading some data that suggests that long COVID globally is going to significantly increase the population of people with long-term disabilities. So sadly, that market opportunity only grows. But, you know, speaking as a consumer, you know, the disabled community seems nearly invisible to me here in the United States, when it comes to product advertising and that kind of thing, unless a company is specifically targeting a disabled demographic, like a firm selling hearing aids or something like that. So why is that the case? And what should give us hope that the situation is going to change?
I think the reason that's been the case is just an unfortunate reality of shall we just say, some of the bad aspects of society, namely that, you know, too many people with disabilities have been stigmatized. They've been seen as too different. They haven't been seen as cool or hip. And why on earth would you ever want to market to someone seen as different or, you know, making it that makes us feel uncomfortable? I mean, these are just, you know, it's just another rampant form of discrimination that has permeated our society. And so, I mean, here's a really kind of sad statistic. If you look at the total amount of retail space dedicated to, selling products for pets, and you add up the space in all the retail outlets in the country, it's actually more than the product space allocated to people with disabilities. And again, I'm pretty confident that the market and the spending power of persons with disabilities is greater than that of dogs and cats. So like, why are we missing this opportunity? Why aren't investors pushing harder on companies to be more cognizant of that opportunity? Having said all that, to, you know, to get to the kind of the second part of your question, I do believe things are changing. I do believe the way that companies are marketing to society, not just to the disability community, is changing. We're becoming far more inclusive in, you know, in how we market things, how we talk about things. And, you know, here's just a very, shall we just say, anecdotal example. You know, last year in late 2021, Nike released a pair of, you know, running shoes, and these were designed to be performance running shoes that allowed the user to slip them on in a very accessible way with, you know, limited use of their hands and arms to get the shoes on. Nike can't keep those shoes in stock because there are so many people without disabilities also buying those shoes. So, you know, here's, it's just another example of a company innovating for the disability population, yet finding it appeals to the mass population. And so I think the more that that happens, and it is happening, the more that the, you know, shall we just say that the barriers, the walls, the unfortunate outcomes of discriminatory practices are coming down.
Bob Luedtke, it's really great to get all of this to chew on. It's an element of inclusivity, I think, that's under-discussed, and your important work at the Harkin Institute is seeking to change that. And so we thank you for spending the time with us here on Double Take to sort of orient us into the state of play. We'll be watching closely. Thank you very much, and best of luck.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you again for this conversation, and I look forward to continuing it with you.
Newton Investment Management North America, LLC, NIMNA, or the firm, is a registered investment advisor and subsidiary of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation, BNY Mellon. The firm was established in 2021, comprised of equity and multi-asset teams from an affiliate, Mellon Investments Corporation. The firm is part of a group of affiliate companies that individually or collectively provide investment advisory services under the brand Newton, or Newton Investment Management, Newton. Newton currently includes NIMNA and Newton Investment Management Limited, Newton Limited. Any statements of opinion constitute only current opinions of NIMNA, which are subject to change and which NIMNA does not undertake to update. This publication, or any portion thereof, may not be copied or distributed without prior written approval from the firm. Statements are correct as of the date of the material only. This document may not be used for the purpose of an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction or in any circumstance in which such offer or solicitation is unlawful or not authorized. The information in this publication is for general information only and is not intended to provide specific investment advice or recommendations for any purchase or sale of any specific security. Some information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources that are believed to be reliable, but the information has not been independently verified by NIMNA. NIMNA makes no representations as to the accuracy or the completeness of such information. No investment strategy or risk management technique can guarantee returns or eliminate risk in any market environment, and past performance is no indication of future performance. The indices referred to herein are used for comparative and informational purposes only and have been selected because they are generally considered to be representative of certain markets. Comparisons to indices as benchmarks have limitations because indices have volatility and other material characteristics that may differ from the portfolio, investment, or hedge to which they are compared. The providers of the indices referred to herein are not affiliated with NIMNA, do not endorse, sponsor, sell, or promote the investment strategies or products mentioned herein, and they make no representation regarding the advisability of investing in the products and strategies described herein. Any forward-looking statements speak only as of the date they are made and are subject to numerous assumptions, risks, and uncertainties, which change over time. Actual results could differ materially from those anticipated in forward-looking statements.
If distributed in the UK, EMEA, Australia, New Zealand, this podcast is issued by Newton Limited and may be deemed a financial promotion. Newton Limited is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, 12 Endeavour Square, London, E20, 1JN, in the conduct of investment business. Registered in England, number 01371973. NIM is also registered as investment advisors with the Securities and Exchange Commission's, SEC, to offer investment advisory services in the United States. If distributed in Canada, this podcast is issued by either Newton Limited, which is availing itself of the International Advisors Exemption, IAE, in the following Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec. The IAE is in compliance with National Instrument 31-103, Registration Requirement, Exemptions, and Ongoing Registrant Obligations, or NIMNA, which is availing itself of the IAE in the following Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, and Manitoba. The IAE is in compliance with National Instrument 31-103, Registration Requirements, Exemptions, and Ongoing Registrant Obligations.